I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Welcome, Austin and Jim. We start the year out normally by talking about what happened in the previous year. Jim, you have some interesting thoughts about some stuff that's gone on in Turkey and some other spots that aren't talked about a lot. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Well, you have to remember that, if you read Strategy Page regularly, you probably know this. We cover the news as it really is, not as it is presented because it's exciting and therefore news that is worth putting headlines on and putting at the front, as it were, of the news feed. This gives people a very warped view of what is really going on in the world. So last year, the big things were obviously, ISIL making a big comeback, as it were, in Iraq and Syria. The Taliban in Afghanistan, terrorism in Pakistan. One thing that people would get from the news feed, as it were, was that, it's Islamic terrorism everywhere. What's going on? Well, we explain what's going on. So when you read Strategy Page, you say, this is stuff I read in the news, but I never read all this other stuff. And we do it, concisely. It's not like we give you reams and reams of stuff to read. It's just that we present it as it actually is in its historical context, for example. We have been talking about how the Iraqi security forces, after the Americans left in 2011, were falling apart, as was the country, because of the corruption. In fact, the one thing that you will find going through all of the unpleasantness, as it were, on the planet is corruption, malfeasance, people basically not doing their jobs.
So, Jim, tell us a little bit about some of your experiences at Fox News on feeding the news monster and like that.
It wasn't just Fox. First, it was CBS in the network news in the 80s, and then Fox a decade later. And what you found out was the guy from CBS who wanted to cover the news as it actually was, not sensationalized, did, as a guy from the Fox later told me, did go back to Chicago, and there was a station that tried that experiment and failed, because it basically did not attract eyeballs. So there is a business reason for covering the news the way it's covered now. But it's not the way, Strategy Page does it.
Right. Austin, can you give your perspective on that, what your experience has been as a syndicated columnist?
With relationship to whether you're going to be hysterical or historical, I suppose is the way
right,
I'm doing
yeah.
it. No, unfortunately, there's always an appeal to that. The push is what's hot now? What's hot now? And just take an example, Dan, what's happened with the week we're recording this, which is the mass murder of cartoonists at Charlie Hebdo in Paris. It's not an isolated incident. Go back to 2006 in the Jones Post. Go back to the threats that are made all the time against critics of quote-unquote radical Islam and, of course, the radical Islamist extremists use it for any kind of criticism. Think of Salman Rushdie, who was the novelist who wrote a novel called Satanic Verses, and the Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini condemned him to death. And they actually were some people who were involved with Rushdie that the Iranians assaulted. It goes on all the time, and that's just a cultural manifestation, if you want, of this long struggle. That's been going on, and the thing is, is that to get back to Jim's point about the media, that's not what they want to hear, because you have a certain political line that says, oh no, you're being condemnatory, you're an Islamophobe, which is ridiculous and wrong and an insult, but they throw it anyway. Or the other one says, gee, that's too complicated to explain, which gets back into what Jim was talking about, why it didn't work.
Yeah. Jim, so what did the media, you had mentioned before we went on air with
with us today that the media had missed something big in Turkey this last year. That the prime minister had said some things, and it wasn't covered well, and it was just, you know, they're misunderstand the media doesn't understand history, and they miss some of these big important events.
It wasn't just Turkey; it was basically all throughout the Middle East. But the most important thing that a head of state in the Muslim world said recently was General al-Sisi, the current elected military leader of Egypt. He did a speech recently, which wasn't covered much by the Western media because it wasn't, hysterical. He basically said, as we've been saying for years, Islam has to reform itself. He basically says, he said what the, again, what the Saudis, which we have pointed out the Saudis have been saying more quietly, but he got out there and said it loud, as it were, that the problem is internal to Islam. And if the Muslims, and he was talking to an audience composed largely of Muslim academics, clerical religious scholars. And Egypt has always been the center of Islamic religious studies in the Islamic world, still is to this day. And he was telling them, he says, look, it's us. As the old American cartoon goes, we have met the enemy and they are us. And the solution is within us. Now, interestingly, this is something the Saudis have been pushing for over a decade. They have what they call the Arab Reform, movement that they fund. And he basically signed on big time.
Austin, just sticking with the Middle East area.
May I make a comment on that? Jim is absolutely right. Al-Sisi's speech, which is I think, occurred at the end of December, didn't it, Jim?
Late
December. Yeah, it's important because Egypt really does matter. But what he is articulating is something that, look, I can show you things from late 18th century Turkey, Ottoman reformers, educators who were Muslims saying, well, Islam needs a reformation. And they're looking at Martin Luther and the Protestant Reformation as not a direct model, but something that says, hey, we've got structures that are destructive and tendencies that using the religion for either oppression or destruction. I mean, these aren't new words. They sound like right out of the today's news, but they were recognized. And al-Sisi has the courage and the intellect to stand up and say this, and at the in as Jim said, it was a group of some of the leading Muslim scholars and educators in Egypt, and it's slowly working its way through some of the commentariat. Dan, is it big? Yeah, there are a lot of other things that are big, but you're talking about something that, look, has a 2.5-3 century scope to it, and here's a guy saying we need it's got to come sooner rather than later. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. But that's tough to say. That's not hysterical enough. That's doesn't get eyeballs is what Jim's point was. So
also, also using the Protestant Reformation, or when I was in high school 50 years ago, the nuns called it the Protestant Revolution. So it shows you how long it takes
to
become what they are, not people what people hope they were. That was a very bloody process because the religion got mixed up with local politics. And that was one thing that was relatively new because before the Protestant Reformation, which is basically modernism, which, the beginning of the Renaissance, the beginning of the rapid proliferation of technology, which was unique in human history. That was the first collision that had with religion. But it only happened with Christianity. The problem with Islam is that it had only come into existence 1,000 years earlier, which is nothing in the grand scheme of things.
Well, what Jim is saying is that there are differences, of course, between the way Islam was structured and the Catholic Church. You had a hierarchy, and Islam was, as Jim's called it, populist. In other ways, it was localized. You had, and the deal is, the local leader, imam, or the scholar who had the who was recognized as an educator and an expert, wielded great authority, local certainly local authority. And the issue that where it becomes, and to pick up on Jim's point about how the Protestant Reformation / Revolution got tied up with local historical issues. Take a look at what has happened with the quote-unquote Islamic extremism of the 20th century, closely tied to the Muslim Brotherhood movement in Egypt, revolutionary and violent, using anarchist methods from the 19th century anarchist movement. That's something that we cover on Strategy Page a great deal. Also picking up Marxist interpretations of history, influenced, and we've written about this, by other totalitarian currents in Europe, fascism, certainly had effects on it. And I'm here, Saeed Qutb is a name to pop up. He's the intellectual founding father of Al Qaeda. He was put to death by Nasser, by the way, in the 1960s, executed. But they're tied up. There's an example of the Islamic extremism that is tied up with local political issues. You see that in Iran as well, and you see it played out through numerous other examples. What Qutb was after, and then bin Laden, was to try to internationalize this and motivate all Muslims to to agree with their group that these were the essential political issues, and that eliminating Western influence, the West was the West, whatever that is at fault. And if we eliminate those and get back and practice the religion as we say it was practiced by the prophet's immediate followers, then everything will be okay. So there's a utopianism with it, utopianism that has a ring of Marxist workers' paradise to it. So when just get back to Jim's point that you're seeing this played out with a lot of Islamic extremism tied up with local issues, and hello, it's not the Protestant Reformation, but it's human beings going through a long process of radical change, and this is what happens, Dan.
Yeah. Jim, let's leave the Middle East and talk about Russia. I think one of the things that the mainstream press missed with Russia, but what we've been covering not only last year but in the previous years is the slow rearming of the former Soviet Union.
There's been an attempt to rearm, to rebuild the armed forces, which basically lost 80% of their manpower in the 1990s, and they've had hardly any new equipment to replace the Cold War era stuff. And they have to do this, otherwise their forces become useless. The other problem in Russia is that in order to... Austin?
Yep, we're still here.
Hearing Austin, talking over me.
No, I didn't mean to. I would cough.
I didn't know if you were trying to say something or what. Anyway.
No, I'm sorry.
Let me continue. Before I get cut off by the system... Russia has a problem in that they never recovered from 70 years of communism, central, economic control. The Chinese were able to do it because they had spent far fewer years as a communist, centralized, economy. And plus they're different. But the Russians were in bad shape in the 90s. They tried this shock therapy, you know, going over to capitalism, market economy like Poland did. It worked in Poland, again, because the Poles had not been a centralized economy for as long, and they were a little different. So Putin came in and decided that, all right, we have to become a police state again. And that's exactly what he's done. The problem is he did this by legalizing, without passing laws, corruption. So you have a state that is basically run as a nationalistic, you know, fan club for the good old days, which are never going to come back. So that's why he's basically trying to reassemble the empire, which is impossible, but he's basically got the tiger by the tail, literally.
Right. Anybody that's tried to build a building in Russia or like that, and I know this because of knowing some things, people that have tried to do this, is that in order to build something in Russia, you have to pay bribes. There's just no way around
it. Well, the worst aspect of that is not just the bribery, but the fact that they keep changing the rules. And that's the reason, for example, that North Korea is not able to attract, you know, foreign investment even from China. It was for a while, but and they were warned by the Chinese government, says you've got to control your corruption. We can Chinese can tolerate a certain amount of it, but too much is counterproductive. They were not able to do that. And literally, the Chinese are staying away from special economic zones, all sorts of favorable deals, because they know from experience that the rules can be changed at somebody's whim. And this is exactly what's happening in Russia. That's why the sanctions that are going on now are not the killer for the Russian economy, as Putin likes to say it is. They were killed before that by foreign capital fleeing and Russian capital fleeing. You know, up to $1 trillion in money earned in Russia by Russians has been taken out of the country because even Russian thieves, corrupt Russian officials, realize that if you want to get a good return on your money, don't invest it in Russia.
And that's probably one of the big differences between Russia and China is the Chinese have kept their money inside China, reinvesting in their infrastructure there.
Yes, because if you get somebody who knows how to operate in China, you can operate in China. You can't do that in Russia. You can't do that in North Korea. The Chinese understand that you can have corruption up to a point. And they tried to explain that to the North Koreans. North Koreans didn't listen.
Right. Austin, let's turn to an area of your expertise, and it's an area that really isn't covered at all by the by the Western media. But what's the biggest thing that happened in Africa over the last year?
Oh goodness, Dan, it's there are a ton of tragedies in Africa. If and we're talking, you're meaning sub-Saharan Africa,
right?
Of course, because you know, we've been North Africa's Egypt and Tunisia. I mean, we could talk about some of the positive things that have happened politically in Tunisia. If I was going to say all of Africa, well, you know, we've already talked about Al-Sisi's speech, and Tunisia has pushed forward with its on its difficult path to democracy. But in sub-Saharan Africa, I have the largest ongoing tragedy, in my view, is the tribal war between Nuer and Dinka, that is the South Sudan civil war. I don't think it has the biggest of geostrategic influence by any stretch. I don't think it's any dirtier than the war that the Sudan, I mean Khartoum here, South Sudan's capital's Juba, but Sudan, which is led by Omar al-Bashir, their president, who's under indictment from the International Criminal Court. They're fighting a dirty war in South Kordofan State against and Blue Nile State against rebels. That's just as ugly, if not uglier, as what's going on in South Sudan. By the way, the war in Darfur continues too, Dan, and it's heating up. But the South Sudan situation, even though in terms of casualty count, is tough to estimate. We're seeing fairly consistently, and this comes from I say we are. I use not only the press but try to look through the sectarian and and human rights organizations reports, because they do have people on the ground on this, somewhere between 15,000 and 20,000 people killed in South Sudan, killing each other in 2014. There are other ongoing horrors. We've written a lot. Jim's written a lot about Nigeria and Boko Haram. And does Mali classify as North Africa or Sub-Saharan Africa? You tell me. It's certainly
Sub-Saharan.
I agree. It's the Sahel transition zone. Totally right. Somalia continues, and then I look at what the UN's intervention brigade, the IBDE, as we call it on strategy page, has been doing in Eastern Congo. That's a big story, and maybe it's a big story in a very small niche. But it's the maturing of UN peacekeeping to say, hey, sometimes you have to go after these bad guys. You can't negotiate with them, and they've been active again against the Allied Democratic Forces, small but vicious Islamist-oriented group that is a Ugandan rebel group, and it's that the biggest and most dangerous story, though, is what begins in the summer of 2014 and then really gels in mid-December 2014, and that's when the – and I wrote about this in my column, and it's on point this past week on Congo, when their president of Congo, Joseph Kabila, announces to the parliament he just might override the Constitution or have it changed, whatever, so he can run for a third term and really become president for life and really undermine the 15 years of peacekeeping and slow but incrementally successful nation-building operation that's been going on in Congo. That's maybe the big story of 2015 or early 2016, at least in sub-Saharan Africa, is that what has been a long, difficult process, and I'll just refer readers to and our listeners to read the column and see why I say what I do about it. I present a historical context for what I had to say about incremental successes. But so that's dangerous. That's a dangerous signal. But to get back to, I said it was South Sudan, and it the problem with a tribal war like that, the Nur and Dinka, on both comprising the Sudan People's Liberation Army that fought Khartoum, they both have got hardened guerrillas that know how to fight, and they're fighting each other. And though nominally the president of South Sudan, who's a Dinka, is trying to, Riek Machar is trying to Salva Kiir, he's the Dinka, and Riek Machar is the former vice president, who's a Nur, are trying to negotiate a peace and a ceasefire. It just doesn't stop, Dan, because go back to Jim talking about the Protestant Reformation, Lutheran, and getting tied up with local issues. Every one of these little tribal regions has local issues, and there they go again, and they start shooting each other. So is some of it about oil fields? Yeah. Is some of it about what you did to my great-grandfather 50 years ago? Jim, do you think that drives these things?
Of course it does. Even the ostensibly religious ones, like in Nigeria with Boko Haram, there's very much a tribal element to it. It's just made worse by adding the militant religious aspect.
Right. Now, Jim, we have... what's been popping in Central – well, we'll leave Central America for Austin, but South America, have we been hearing much out of them over the past year?
Well, there's good news and bad news. The good news is Colombia, which 10 years ago was a basket case because of drug gangs. It was the main source of cocaine in the world. And leftist revolutions, which had started in the 60s and were still going strong – both have been, not that totally defeated, but basically pushed back. The drug business has largely moved next door to Peru, Ecuador. The two largest leftist organizations, FARC and ELN, are basically suing for peace, as it were, because they're being regularly, gradually ground out to nothing. At the same time, next door in Venezuela, a demagogue, military officer, Hugo Chavez, a decade ago, after several failed coup attempts, he finally got elected president and proceeded to try and turn the country into a socialist, dictatorship. All they've managed to do was to ruin the economy, economy basically that had been kept afloat for decades by a lot of oil. And that's become a basket case. It's become a country with the highest crime rate, murder rate in the world, which is saying something, considering the competition. Colombia has the most rapidly declining, economic growth in Latin America. Venezuela is going quite literally in the opposite direction. You have several other countries in South America that are following one or the other country, but the one thing that's common in South America is this fondness for strongmen, for dictatorships, for populism or socialism, whatever you want to call it, for pie in the sky. It never seems to get delivered. And that is something that's cultural, that you can't just, click your, heels and have it go away. And even examples of how a market economy and basically a civil society works in Colombia doesn't impress a lot of the neighbors.
Right. Austin, Central America, what's been popping there over the last year?
Well, I regard Mexico as being a part of North America, and that's what the geologists say too. I mean, take a look at it. But nevertheless, I know that's part of why you're asking me about it, and the reason I start with that is because of the effects of the Mexican cartel war. Guatemala has been disrupted. I think I only wrote one piece about that. We used to cover Guatemala more carefully when the guerrilla war was still going on. That's lapsed, and now we're back to narco traficantes moving between northern South America. I'm saying Venezuela, Colombia, Ecuador, and Peru, and Mexico, and the southern United States. That's the spillover effect there, and there has been, as I think both Jim and I have written a little bit about this. Usually it's ascribed to the Zetas. It may be other smaller cartel factions. And when I say maybe, that comes from the Guatemalan government and Mexican security agencies talking about the disruption in Guatemala's Petén region, which is essentially it's adjacent to southern Mexico and Chiapas and the jungle area down there. But let's move north. And we've had another year of the cartel war. Yes, I am extremely hard on President Enrique Peña Nieto of the Institutional Revolutionary Party, PRI, Priista. For those of you who read our Mexico updates, know all the political jargon. Why am I hard on him? Because he ran against Calderon's quote-unquote militarization of the cartel war, and guess what? He's learned that that's the Mexican military. The Army and Navy are the really the only reliable security tools when facing the firepower and embedded, absolutely embedded corruption that permits organized criminal operations to operate the way they do in Mexico. So the Operation Michoacán, Michoacán, I'm mispronouncing it, but that's all right. In western Mexico continues. Tamaulipas and Nuevo León, you're in Zeta territory and also Gulf Cartel territory are more major operations. But the biggest story in Mexico, and one that I suspect It's already having profound political effects within Mexico, Dan, is the so-called Iguala Massacre. Now, there are other names for it, the Iguala incident, but it was at the end of September, and we've covered this in detail, by the way. I think I've done at least one column on the Iguala Massacre. But it was 43 students at a normal college, a teacher's college near Iguala, and they were murdered, they were abducted, kidnapped, and then murdered, disappeared. They couldn't be found. And the abduction was, there were pictures, video, cell phone video, of the police putting them in police vans. And then there were stories within a week. What happened is that suddenly the local police were, this is some credit goes to the national government for doing this, so Pena gets credit for, or at least the national, the federales and national security agencies get some credit for this, started getting involved, at least minimally, in the investigation. But within 10 days, the state cops had found evidence that the police had abducted them and that a local faction of a cartel had murdered all 43 of these students, and that this has now been shown to have been the case, even though it was initially denied. We will say this, though. President Peña, I want to say 6th or 7th of October, said there was going to be a full investigation of it because of the information it couldn't be ignored in Mexico City. Well, here's what happened in Iguala. As Jim called her, he called her Senora Macbeth, and we had a very ironic headline, Senora Macbeth Sets the Country on Fire, I think is what Jim titled that update. The mayor's wife of Iguala, who was intended to run for mayor herself and replace her husband when he left office, had told her husband and the local police chief that she didn't want any interference from these students who were political activists. And so the police, in conjunction with their local allies, who happened to be in the narcotics gang, got rid of them and killed them. And it is an example of the worst, unfortunately, there are claims, and when I'm backtracking here just a little bit to give you background, I've read some things from the Mexican press. Hey, there are 100 towns like Iguala. Well, there may be 200 in Mexico, where the municipal cops are nothing but a tool of oppression of the people for the local elites. And that's huge, Dan. It has received some coverage. But if you will look at some of the comments that one of the columns I wrote, I think it was in November, we got some interesting comments. There weren't a lot on that, but there was one fellow who had been in Mexico who had listened to a press conference that I wrote about and said, hey, this just is not being covered in the United States, and this is the biggest story in Mexico. And he had been listening to the press conference, he said, on the radio while he was driving on a highway back to, I think he said he was driving from Western Mexico into Mexico City. And, you know, he had a couple of things he disagreed with me on what I'd said was, but he said, basically, Mr. Bay, you've got, you not only have the thing, you know, scoped out, you realize how big this is, you know. So I just, it's there. And Dan, what happens in Mexico matters for a lot of reasons. Jim's written here, I'm saying Jim's written about almost everything, but the thing is, it does matter because it's so big. Has so many resources. It is right on the U.S. border. We have a huge border. And heck, it's part of NAFTA. You know, it matters a great deal. So,
Jim, why don't you wrap it up for us? Talk a little bit about Asia.
The problem in Asia continues to be China, which has got a little bit of the Russian, how do I keep the people happy while I'm oppressing them disease. And they are also following the nationalist, let's rebuild the empire script. And that has led to disputes with almost all their neighbors. Of course, they're allies with Russia now because Russia's in big trouble with the sanctions. And the Russians are basically willing to sell the Chinese everything they wouldn't sell them before, mainly military technology, manufacturing technology, etc. But many Russians are pointing out, some of them quite loudly, that, you know, Russia has designs on much of eastern Russia, you know, the Far East, Vladivostok. There's a lot of real estate out there that the Chinese have historically wanted. Now they have a lot of people and they still need the land. So the Chinese, although they have basically been aggressive, they've also been prudent. Thus, they have not got a lot of sanctions against them. They have not got the entire world up in arms, as it were. The Chinese take a longer view, and the neighbors know this. The Chinese will just keep, you know, pressing until, you know, the fruit drops out into their laps, as it were. And it may well work. You know, the neighbors are very nervous. They're basically pressuring the United States to provide some muscle because, you know, except for Japan, none of the countries in the area have the muscle to oppose China. And because the Japanese don't have the nuclear weapons that the United States has. You know, Japan is also very unpopular from the atrocities they committed during World War II. Westerners tend to forget that or not appreciate how deep that hatred is. The Japanese were very ill-behaved during World War II, and they have long memories in that part of the world. So China is a danger, but the Chinese have a lot to lose. I mean, the Russians have not built up an economy. The Russians are very much dependent upon oil and natural gas. The Chinese have built up a manufacturing, a trading economy, which is all at risk if they basically go into a outright war situation. So good news and bad news. Bad news is the Chinese are getting aggressive. They are making a nuisance of themselves. They are rattling sabers, and they're building more sabers and bigger sabers. They do have nukes. But at the same time, the Chinese have shown that they are prudent about their use of this aggression. Besides China, there's not that much of a problem in Asia. The Islamic terrorism never really was able to gain much of a foothold, again, because of cultural differences. There are a lot of Muslims in East Asia, especially in Indonesia, but they don't generate as much heat as they do in other parts of the world, like, you know, Pakistan, Afghanistan, the Middle East, Africa. So, you know, Asia, compared to the other parts of the world, isn't doing so bad.
Well, that's good that there's some place that's not doing too bad. Well, that'll wrap us up for today. We're out of time, and we'll talk to you both next time.
Take care, Dan.